In his work as a speechwriter to senior politicians and business leaders around the world, Philip Collins has become well-versed in understanding what it is that makes a speech great. When they go low, we go high. His new book explores the ways in which the most notable speeches in history have worked, analysing the tricks to uncover how the right speech at the right time can profoundly shape the world. Delighted to be joining me on the programme, author of When They Go Low, We Go High, Philip Collins. Philip, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Are speeches still important, would you say, in the world of politics when we seem to be being governed by tweets, social media and sound bites?
Well, we're definitely changing, yeah. I mean, tweets and social media are changing politics, definitely. But the speech is surviving because we saw in Britain Theresa May's conference speech was massive news when the letters fell off the backdrop and when she couldn't get through because she was coughing. So the doing a big set-piece speech is still a big political moment. And we don't need to go so far back in history. And Barack Obama really spoke his way to the presidency. So that set-piece speech really does still survive. And even in a world where we're cutting things up into tiny segments in social media, the set-piece is still an important thing.
I mean, would you say the phrase, the title of the book, When They Go Low, We Go High, that is an Obama speech, is it not?
That's right, it's Michelle Obama, yeah. She's endorsing Hillary Clinton for president, so it didn't actually work. And it shows that speeches don't always have the impact that the speaker hopes they'll have. But it was a lovely phrase, which I thought, at a time when politics is in pretty low esteem, I thought the idea that politics needs to go high with elevated, poetic language was a really nice one to remind people of, because there's an awful lot of politics going low. We get that all the time, and we always have. We should resist the idea that everything's worse than it used to be. It's always been terrible. You've got terrible speeches all the way back to, through the history of public speech. But you've also got, at various moments, some really fantastic moments. And I just wanted to remind people that, at its best, politics can be very good.
So, I mean, where did you start? Because you go way back. I mean, you say the respect, veneration and hope first expressed by Pericles, and that's going back, has gone missing. It's the grand purpose of this book to help call it back. So you've gone right back to the founding of democracy and the plebiscite as started by the Romans.
I have. I start the earliest speech in the book is, as you say, Pericles, which is 431 BC. And the reason I start there is that that is the first time that you get a major speech which is about the idea of the people, of democracy. And so rhetoric and democracy are born at the same time, because it's only really in a democracy that you have to persuade anyone. If you are a tyrant, you can tell people what to do. But in a democracy, suddenly, speech becomes a very important thing. And then the next speech in time in the book is Cicero in the Roman Republic. And that idea of the Roman Republic, of the people, then becomes very important in the foundation of America. So there's a link that takes us all the way through to first the 18th century and then all the way through to John F. Kennedy and Obama. So you've got this link all the way through. And the two things, speech and democracy, are joined all the way through.
You say speech and democracy, however, I mean, would you say that a great orator can also carry off a speech, even if it's not a democracy? I mean, you have a speech there by Adolf Hitler, who was renowned for his style of oration, for example.
I do. I didn't want to shy away from the fact that rhetoric can also be terrible, and it can be very technically brilliant and effective for really bad purposes, and Hitler is one example of that. I have a couple of others too, Robespierre and the French Revolution, and in a slightly different way, Fidel Castro, because you can be a great speaker and have a fantastic effect through brilliant theatrical dynamics, and Hitler is the example that really we have to contend with. And so the point of the book, of that part of the book, is to say we need to be on guard against certain forms of rhetoric. It's not always good. It can, in fact, be dreadful.
We're looking at the earliest examples of speech writing and the good of oration, and you go back to antiquity. You've even got speeches by Elizabeth I in there. You know, you've got speeches by Lloyd George, etc. Since, should we say, and I thought this was an event, a sort of invention of JFK, of the Kennedys, who many would think would be the first media savvy president of the United States. You remember the debate between him and Richard Nixon, when Nixon was fluffing his lines and Kennedy was young and bright and the future of the Camelot of the Americas. And I thought that he was the man who introduced speechwriters to the White House, but actually it goes a little bit further than that.
It does, yeah. The first person to introduce a full speechwriting unit was Nixon, but Thomas Jefferson had help with his inaugural address back in 1801. So there were speechwriters of a kind were employed all the way back. But in a sense, you're right, because the first time the speechwriter becomes a very central figure is with Ted Sorensen and John F. Kennedy. That's when it becomes really quite famous. And the speechwriter, as we know them today in American politics and in British politics, does date from around then. But that's not to say previous presidents hadn't had help. And in fact, one of the things I'm often charged with is that if only politicians wrote their own speeches, this would be a lot better, because then somehow they'd be authentic. Well, the truth is, they'd just be a bit worse. It wouldn't necessarily be more authentic. They just wouldn't be very good at it. And it's a very old charge. You can go all the way back to antiquity, and people were saying the Emperor Nero was ticked off by Claudius because Seneca wrote his speech. This is the oldest charge there is. And I don't really buy it, because those speeches that Kennedy did, the famous one, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country," that was written largely by his speechwriter, Ted Sorensen. But it was done with Kennedy, and very much they worked it out together, and it becomes Kennedy's when he says it. Mm. Ronald Reagan's another good example, where he didn't really write much. He had really brilliant writers. Peggy Noonan is his brilliant speechwriter. But Reagan was a fantastic actor, as obviously, because that's what he had been. And he delivered it so beautifully that therefore the lines become his in the end.
I mean, you were a speechwriter for Tony Blair, who again was brilliant at getting the message across. Presumably, the Prime Minister will come to you and say, "I've got an idea. This is what we want to get across." And it is almost like putting an album together or a musical composition together, and everybody chips in.
It is. It is exactly like that. I've often likened it to putting music together, because you're looking for the music as well as the words, and you're looking for it all to kind of come together and resolve. And it is a collective effort, and there's lots of people involved. One of the tasks of the speechwriter is to try and keep other people at bay, because when you're writing for a prime minister, loads of people understandably want to join in, and they all want to get their bit in. And this has always happened. So with that Kennedy speech, loads of people were sending in their unsolicited paragraphs, and Sorensen was having to throw them all out, because you've got to try and keep a central voice. But you end up doing a sort of band composition. But ultimately, in the end, there has to be a voice. Unless a band has a sound, then you don't know who it is. And so you've got to keep that voice. And therefore, as a speechwriter, you've got to be the editor-in-chief.
The other thing is these great speeches that we remember, they always seem to take place at a specific point in time where something major is needed. Or is it, for the dramatic effect, Ich bin ein Berliner, that sort of thing, I have a dream. Or can these great speeches come from great occasion, or can you occasionally get a great speech just in a meeting hall that stirs people into action? Or have you gone for those speeches that have defined democracy, with if you like, a build-up?
I think it's definitely the great occasion makes the great speech. I don't think you can manufacture the moment. Take the great example of Nelson Mandela, who's pleading for his life in court, and that already has got an incredible drama, because he's pleading for him his own survival, and he talks about the society in which black people and white people might be able to live together, and he ends by saying, "This is an ideal which I hope to live to see realized, but if needs be, it is an idea for which I'm prepared to die." Now that is incredible, but you can't say that if you're just doing a speech after lunch at the local Rotary Club. It just won't work. You've got to have that moment and that dramatic effect. The best example of this is Churchill, who is one of the greats in the history of speech. But Churchill had a terrible tendency in his early career to just lavish all his rhetorical skill on tiny little events. So there's one occasion when, and you'll recognise the rhythm of these sentences, it's in 1908, and he's a junior minister in Africa, and he's standing around a hole in the ground of an irrigation scheme, and he says, never before in the history of Africa has so much water been held up by so little masonry. And it's absolutely terrible, because the occasion just isn't big enough. But then in 1940, just after the Battle of Britain, and he's able to say, never before in the field of human conflict has so much been owed by so many to so few. And suddenly, because the nation is at war and it's genuine peril, then the rhetoric seems reasonable. It seems appropriate.
And what do you... Yes, absolutely.
So it's definitely the occasion, in my view. I think you can't manufacture it.
Trains in Africa were never going to get the population going, really, were they? Let's be honest.
Not really.
Also, you've drawn parallels. You've looked to see what Thomas Jefferson owed to Pericles and Cicero, and also what Elizabeth I shared with Churchill.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, Elizabeth I is a fantastic speech where we don't know for certain she ever delivered it, because we don't have, obviously, contemporary records. All we've got is a letter written 35 years later with a script. But insofar as we think she did say something like it, Elizabeth I is there trying to ward off the Spanish Armada, and she's trying to rally the troops, very much like Churchill does in the House of Commons in 1940. But she's got an extra thing she's got to contend with, which is that she's a woman. And the criticism at the time, as you can imagine, is how can a woman be commander of the armed forces? It's ridiculous. And so she produces this fantastic retort, which is, I may have the weak and feeble body of a woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king, and a king of England too. And it's a great triumph. And so she completely defines the nation by her speech. And the way we think of Elizabeth I now as this really indomitable character owes a lot to our sense of that speech. So it's an amazing sense of character that every good speech has to have.
When you're putting this book together, and with your background at the highest level of politics, as I said before at the beginning of this interview, we are living in a time now where we are dominated by social media, Instagram posts, fake news, and tweets coming out of nowhere. And it seems that the general population, the populace, and the voting populace has the attention span of 140 or 120 280 characters. Do you think now more than ever that we need to reinvent the speech to give people that idea that politics is indeed a noble cause, and it's not just the rich and the powerful feathering their nests, as I said before, that politicians need to find the words that inspire and give hope? On the end of that, we seem to have lost my guest. I will try and get him back after this break. I think we just proved one thing and one thing only with that technical thing. Cicero had it easy. He never had an order cue break down or a line cut off. Philip, I was halfway through my pomp and circumstance then, but basically, you know, now more than ever, with populist movements and people seem to be very distracted by all the social media, all the smoke and mirrors, all the noise, now more than ever, speeches and a well-honed political speech can really focus the attention of a people, of a nation.
Yes, it can, and it must do. It is harder than it used to be because of all the noise. It is harder to get through. You don't get the same attention that you did, so you've got to try harder. So, and that's the only thing you can do. There's no point sort of giving up, because if you are good enough, you can still cut through. I mean, even somebody like Donald Trump, of whom I'm not a great fan, but he actually is quite effective in his speaking, and he did quite a lot of speeches in the Rust Belt of America that spoke very directly to people's sense that they hadn't had a pay rise for 30 years and that they were getting nothing out of politics. So although I didn't particularly like his message, he had diagnosed something, and it shows that even someone like that, they're doing something quite conventional, as well as all the unconventional stuff. He worked out what was really bothering people, and he talked about it. So even Trump is a bit of an example of the importance of connecting to people's fears and a sense of what's going on in the world.
And I suppose the other thing is the fact that hopefully with this book we will bring back the importance of debate, because one other thing about having a speech, a well-crafted speech, is opening up a debate, and not just the automatic name-saying, gainsaying, attack, personal attack, slagging off that we are seeing prevailing in all aspects of life. And perhaps something like studying a well-crafted speech will open up an idea for sensible, intelligent debate.
I think that's very important. And all the speeches that I've chosen as the good ones all have a debate within them. I think a mistake that bad writers and bad speakers make is to do a sort of cartoon version of your opponents, to do basically insults and caricature. And that is always tempting, but it never really works, because as an audience member, you just feel patronized. You feel, well, actually, that's not what I really think. Whereas if you name the opposition well, and correctly and generously, and then you take on the argument, something really good happens in the speech. So a speech is obviously a monologue. You're standing up there by yourself. But there is a disguised conversation in it. You've got to be having an argument with somebody. And so if you set that up well, you have a much better speech than if you just do basic insults, and too many speeches are of that kind. I mean, there's too much bad knockabout political rhetoric, which has become really boring.
When you finished writing this book, and when you did that magic no moment when you pressed the send key and off to your publisher, but did going back through these speeches, did it inspire, did it revitalize your thought in the democratic process and the what we are capable as if politics and democracy works well?
It did, actually. Yeah, it really did. It reminded me of how much we've achieved. And when I came to do the conclusion, I started to think, well, why are there fewer great speeches today than there once were? And I realized it's because of the achievements that are in the book. So the fact that we don't have to do quite the same speech that Martin Luther King did on I Have a Dream is because, although things have still got a long way to go, they're better than they used to be. And the reason we don't have to do speeches as Disraeli did about the slums and cholera is that those things have been fixed. So the world is better than it used to be, and the great speeches have helped to produce that. And that makes it harder then to find major injustices. Because the one thing that is in common with all these things is the occasion, as I said before. But it's also the sense of an injustice. There is something which is seriously unjust that the speaker is naming and trying to put right. And I don't think for one second that the countries in the developed world are perfect. There's loads of things still wrong, but they're a lot more hospitable to live in than they used to be in the 18th and 19th century. And so that does make doing a great speech a lot harder than it used to be.
If you had to select one to sort of stir the lawyer, gird the loins and get you going on a Monday, if you were flicking through the book, Philip, which one would you say that this is perhaps your go-to for taking on the world and stirring the emotions, from your excellent book?
Definitely it would be Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream. It was my favorite before I found out about it, and after I discovered what I'm just about to tell you, it became my favorite even more. Martin Luther King's team decided that on no account should he do I Have a Dream. He'd done a similar riff on that many times on the campaign trail, and they said, it's become boring, don't do that. And King agreed with them, so they wrote a brand new speech called The Cancel Check. And for the first 12 minutes on the March in Washington, that's the speech that he delivers. And it's quite flat. There's no great audience reaction. There's this gospel singer called Mahalia Jackson who used to travel with the Martin Luther King entourage, and she's behind him on the podium, and she whispers in his ear, tell them about the dream, Martin. Tell them about the dream. So he lays his script aside, and from memory, he does the famous riff about I Have a Dream. And it's absolutely fantastic. And I know from doing speeches myself and watching people I've written for do it off the top of their heads, you suddenly think, oh my God, where's this going to go? Can you do it without any script? And he does it so amazingly. So the fact that he's doing those famous last few minutes, the end, free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last, and he hasn't got any script at all, makes it even better. It's an extraordinary few minutes of uplifting speech. That's my favourite by a distance, I think.
Absolutely, because normally when people go off message, as we've seen recently, you can see the people around them shaking their heads and getting very nervous. Very nervous.
You do, because you don't know where they're going. anything could happen once you go off the script.
The book is called When They Go Low, We Go High. It's by Philip Collins. It's out now on Fourth Estate. Philip, if people want to find out what you are up to and a little bit more about the book and the fabulous speeches, and they'll be able to download the electronic versions of it, of course, where can they find you?
I can be found in the Times all the time. I'm always analysing speeches and writing columns in the Times. And they can find me on Twitter. I'm there dealing with all the people who shout at me all the time. So I can be found in those places.
And it only begs the question, Philip, after doing this book and what a tome it is, what's he going to be looking at next? Are you going to be doing perhaps the worst speeches that you've ever, and things that have gone wrong, including auto cues breaking down, slogans falling off the back, P45s being produced, and on live interviews, phone lines being cut off?
Well, I did think of doing the worst speeches, actually. I mean, although they'd quickly get boring, because the reason they're the worst is that they're dull, that people haven't got anything to say. So the book would quite quickly dissolve. So I think what I'm going to do is, I think, for some of the reasons we've been talking about today, that politics has become quite extreme, and you've got, and also quite low caliber at the moment. So I want to think, if there were a new party or a new political movement could emerge in the middle, a bit like Macron in France, if that could emerge in other countries, what would it be? What would it stand for? What ideas would it have to suggest to give that uplift and that sense of purpose that I say is so important in this book? So I might try and supply the ideas that could do that, the thing that I say is necessary at the end of this book.
We look forward to that one then. Philip Collins, author of When They Go Low, We Go High, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Philip Collins, the author of When They Go Low, We Go High.